Awesome to welcome NBA coach Charles Clask to the Basketball Podcast. Charles is a highly respected NBA coach and NBA champion, most notably serving on the Denver Nuggets staff during their historic 2023 NBA championship season. He brings decades of NBA experience, having held coaching and advanced scouting roles with the Denver Nuggets, Detroit Pistons, Brooklyn Nets, and Orlando Magic. Throughout his career, Clask has been deeply involved in game preparation, player development, opponent scouting, working with generations of All-Star and Hall of Fame level talent. Beyond the NBA, Clask has made a significant international impact through hands-on leadership roles. He served as an assistant coach and defensive coordinator for the Senegal national team in 2022 and has coached at the Basketball Without Borders program. Clask also shares his expertise globally as a guest speaker, clinician, and analyst, blending modern analytics, teaching methodology, and relationship-driven coaching into a championship-level approach. Hey, coach, brief interruption from your podcast to hear from one of our top supporters, Hoopsalytics. Is your starting lineup not performing to your expectations? What if your star player is injured? Who should you play together instead? You can answer questions like this using the powerful Hoopsalytic basketball platform to reveal your most productive players and lineups. Just ask the AI assistant, and based on extensive player and lineup stats and analytics, you'll get accurate, data-driven answers instantly. You can literally ask anything about teams and players and then start making even better strategic decisions. Hoopsalytics also provides top-tier video link stats with a 12-hour turnaround time, as well as handy visualizations, interactive shot charts, coaching stats, easy-to-create film sessions, and lots more. And unlike the alternatives, you get unlimited video storage with no hidden fees. Best of all, Hoopsalytics is more affordable. Now in year seven, Hoopsalytics is a true game changer for thousands of basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball and start using advanced stats and AI. Coach Clask, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on. Just honored and pleasure to be here. Always admire you and everything you do for the community.
That's mutual, good friend, and maybe at some point we'll tell the story of how we met, but just incredible to be able to follow your journey along the years. And we're here to talk about conceptual defense. So, Charles, maybe let's start with that. What is conceptual defense?
Like the origin of all this was with the advent of conceptual offense, it got a lot harder to play defense. Teams weren't calling plays, they weren't running sets. They were putting people in different positions, having them do different assignments, having them re-trigger in different ways. So unable to keep up with the offense, you just have to figure out a way to apply your principles with your underlying goals for what best suits your personnel and how you can take advantage of their weaknesses and leverage your strengths to get them out of their actions and make them do something else. So that was the origin.
It makes sense. Adaptability, definitely the importance of that, and especially at the NBA level when you're dealing with so many individual unique players and team systems and the different things that come with it. And you referenced this for me, and I want you to talk about this a little bit. When you say defense has never been grayer, what does that mean? And then what does that do for us as coaches in terms of trying to figure out how to counter that?
I think as basketball morphs more into like soccer and hockey, where it's so free flowing, away from the American football model of you have set assignments, set tasks, set jobs, you go A to B, very program based. That was to me black and white. When I was first getting into the league, it was like, hey, you run this cut from this position to catch the ball at this spot and then run this pick and roll. And it was very sequential. You knew what was coming. And then as the defenses evolved, they were able to deny the first pass and then it ruined the rest of your offense or take away one side of the floor and now you can't reverse it. And kind of what we already said with the ball, with the offense becoming more and more conceptual and more gray, so too is the defense. The player skill level is tremendous. It's unlocked so many different options. It's very difficult to be black and white. A lot of coaches on offense, they're not saying you have to start here and screen here to get the catch there. It's much more free flowing. And then what I like to say too is while that part of the game is gray, the things that have to be black and white are tried and true principles of effort, energy, toughness, intensity, communication, and then your ability to read and react is really on display.
And let's get beyond those things as coaches, right? Let's assume we've got those things already in place, because in the absence of effort and all those non-negotiables you said, none of this matters, right? The tactics don't matter if we don't have those things. Going a little deeper, this is going to challenge coaches quite a bit, because a lot of coaches insist defense is rules, offense is more flexible. And then obviously they all have their list of non-negotiables on defense when it comes to certain things, whether it's closeouts, et cetera, et cetera. So what are we saying to these coaches now that are considering adapting their tried and true defense to be more adaptable?
What I would ask the coaches is, why are you playing with more pace and less precision? Why are you playing more conceptual? Because it's obviously unpatterned. It's much harder to predict what's going to happen. So defensively, you're just flipping. It's just the inversion principle, right? And then you have to rely more on the abilities and instincts of your players to read and react. But what I like to do is try to make everything more read-based. So if it's read and react offense, how do we make it read and react defense? Okay, I know they're running this stagger for Dante DiVincenzo on the left side of the floor. We've seen it on the film. We've scouted it. His primary objective is to catch, curl, and shoot the three. How I get to that point to stop that and prevent that option is really up to me based on my skills and abilities, whether we're top locking, whatever the coverage is. And a lot of times, they're not always going to use the same timing of the play. So I can't always get into the top lock the way I'd like to, but I know his goal and how to prevent it. And then the other four players that are defending with me all read and react to what I do. So we're all on a chain ready to react. That would be my first step, is ask the coaches why they've gone to conceptual offense and then flip it on them.
I love that. I love that approach. And you mentioned read-based. I want to dive into that a little bit more, but let's frame this a little bit, because this is not just about the NBA. You and I have talked about this. I'm doing this with youth players, where I'm not giving them specific, this must happen all the time on defense. And for me, what it starts with, if we're talking about the lower levels, is who's your check and what's your responsibility? And responsibilities, I assume at your level as well, are always relative to the basketball. But sometimes who's your check changes your responsibility too. So let's start with simple framing of this and build from there.
Yeah. So basically, the impetus of a lot of this was when I was in Orlando and Coach Van Gundy first got there. He's an exceptional teacher, right? And one thing he said on not giving up strong side corner threes was shrink as much as possible without giving up a strong side three. And when he said that, he included the context of that's different for different people. Now, if that's me, I can't shrink that much because I can't get out to a really good shooter in the corner. If that's Chris Oliver, who's a high-level athlete, he can do both. He can give more support and still affect the three-point shot, right? And so what I basically did is I tried to apply that theory into as many categories as possible on defense throughout my career, where, okay, let's say X5, we want him to be in a drop. He's going to play a drop in the pick and roll. Now we say, hey, be up as much as possible at the level without giving up a roll lob. Okay. And then what he does is he self-organizes based on his own abilities and skill sets, knowing that parameter of I'm not giving up a roll lob and still playing both. And basically, we just continue to do that with all players and all abilities.
And I love this from a teaching learning perspective, which I know you're big into as well, is this actually helps a player process the information, retain the information, retrieve the information more, because you're dealing with a lot of questions that aren't must, but are possibilities relative to your positioning and relative to who you're covering as well. And to me, that really does help a player, to the point that in the 7th, 8th grade game this weekend, one of the players on our team literally made a decision before the coach even cued them to start denying a player who had made 2 straight baskets. And to me, that's shaped by being conceptual rather than this is your rule and you must be here. And if you're not here, you're in trouble, that type of situation. So talk to us about that part of it, where it's like we're holding players accountable to doing things, but they're not wrong and they can make themselves right, or their teammates can make themselves right too.
Everything is going to be rule-based, and I know some people shy away from the word rule because there are no absolutes, but I think of rules as guidelines. So we tell them, hey, here's the goals of our defense. We're not going to give up any easy layups. no needless fouls that where they can get to the free throw line, and no spot up threes. And then once you give them that construct, they can fill in the context of that and how they accomplish those things. And then anytime they're not following those guidelines or going off script per se, but you just simply ask them, what did you see? What did you feel? What did you notice that made you shy away from our core principles? And they might surprise you with some really good answers. Hey, I thought I had the steal, or the ball handler couldn't see where I was coming from. I shot the gap and went for it, whatever it is. So you have to start with your overarching goals of what you want to take away defensively, and then give them some guidelines of how we're going to do that. But again, it goes back to the whole gray area thing. You're letting them read and react based on what they're seeing. And then the relationship with the other four players, again, let's just go back to me. I'm guarding the ball. I can't guard anyone, right? I'm the worst defender on the team. My other four players need to know that. So their shrink spots have to adjust accordingly. But you're always trying to leverage your strengths and mitigate your weaknesses.
Love that. And it's basically, again, a parallel to offense is like this concept of, yeah, you can teach a structure, but you want that structure to become unstructured because it makes you more malleable and more adaptable, which obviously leads to some success, which is great. Another just point was like this old concept of like you got to straddle the helpline when you're in help, right? And one of the first things I learned as a young coach is like that's not the greatest positioning if it's a bad matchup for us. For example, Charles is covering the ball. Then you should be
Right.
cheating on the other side of the helpline. And thank you for framing me as the better defender, better athlete. And if Chris is covering it, you can cheat farther to the weak side. So, like adapting relative to that.
Correct. Everything is based on your skills, right? And your teammates' skills, and then the opponent's skills. So you weight those accordingly. If it's two equal players, your help is 50-50 at the midpoint between both. If it's what we call the ace, the best player on the offensive side of the ball, we're usually 60-40. If I'm guarding a really bad shooter, it's 70% to the ball, 30% to my man. So again, that you're always in relationship to your man and the ball or the action taking place. You're trying to create a hierarchy that they can apply during the game with a lot of like if-then type statements, conditional statements, without them overthinking things.
What do you mean by building a hierarchy?
Basically, a hierarchy to me is think of like a decision branch where the first thing we want to take away is this, if not that, knowing what's most important, prioritizing certain things, certain elements of the game, whether it's limiting a star player from getting open shots or their best shooter from open shots. And you can just apply those. So if I know, hey, we are not going to let James Harden come off the pick and roll to his left hand, we're forcing him to his right hand no matter where the screen is located. That would be a hierarchy. Now, how we apply those things is with certain terminology or coverages throughout the game. It's just basically a way to formulate your decision-making process.
So providing them basically a framework for decisions, which is beautiful. And then I know like coaches are sitting here at home or listening wherever they're listening and they're going, okay, this is all great, but how do you teach it? And I know we'll spend a bulk of time there, but let's first start with, I think, one of the core concepts that you threw out, which is we need to establish some baselines. So what do you mean by that and what are some potential baselines?
Yeah, basically, you go through and you realize the skills of your players. You do an inventory or an audit. What are our players capable of doing? Do we have size at the rim where we can play in a drop? Do we have athleticism on the wings where we can pressure, deny? You want to put them in a situation where they can both best be productive. So, like in your introductory team meeting, you've already done an evaluation on your guys. You kind of have a feel for what it's going to take for this team to win and not to lose. And then you basically open it up to the floor of the team and ask them what they think this team needs to do in order to win, or what they need to do to prevent losing, right? And this makes it a more collaborative approach. I always felt like if you want the players to eventually take ownership to the product that you're putting on the floor, it's really hard for you to just force your theories and principles on them. But if you can collaboratively build those together, they really feel like it's theirs. Because the goal for me is to create independent critical thinkers who can get it done on the court almost without me. Because a lot of times it's so loud in the arenas, or the defense is on the far end away from your bench. And what are you going to do in those moments when you don't know what's coming? You don't know the play. Are you really relying on the instincts of your players? And then what the beauty behind making it a collaborative is you always want to get a feel for what they already know and what their values already are. So before you even go onto the court, you can realize, hey, we have a really cerebral group. We don't have to start with shell basics, closeout basics. They get it. They understand it. It's almost like if you were a sixth grade math student, I might not have to go back and teach you addition and subtraction. You've already mastered those steps. It's more of a mastery-based learning system. And then the other thing too is you want them to give you clear examples of what those values look like. So if we say, hey, we're going to be a tough team, we're never backing down from a fight, we're always hitting first. Okay, what does that look like? Being a tough team is fighting through a screen. Great. Being a tough team is boxing out, even if it's a point guard on a center. Great. Taking a charge, a verticality. And then that starts to build your baselines for what you can expect. And then you set standards around those where, okay, we're a no layup team. No matter what, we're never giving up open layups. Those are going to get you beat at every level. And that means we're going to be early help. We're going to read penetration, early help, chain reaction behind, scramble to the three. So once you establish those baselines, whether it's looking at the statistics of the league, what's your conference's league average for points per possession or three-point shooting or rim field goal percentage, and then just basically building your system out from there.
So many great points there. One, obviously, this concept, which coaches, I want you to understand, Charles said this, your goal is to foster independence. That's ultimately the goal of all this, is that your players become independent learners, independent performers. And we'll talk about CLA, constraint-led approach, games approach, stuff like that helps them do that. But that's really the foundation of kind of everything we're trying to do. You talked about empowering your players, and I want to stay there for one second. Can you give us, say, an example of maybe how you would phrase that to a player, because we're not empowering them in every situation, but maybe give us an example, if you don't mind, of maybe somewhere where this has happened and somewhere where this is something that coaches can understand a little bit deeper, how we can empower them.
I think one is creating an environment that they're not afraid to fail in, especially in the practice environment. I got this from listening to a Bill Belichick interview one time, and he talked about training camp with Tom Brady. And anytime there was a turnover or he threw a pass that was maybe outside the catch zone or whatever, he never lost his mind about it because he wanted them to explore what was possible, right? And if he came in with the lens of don't try anything, fear of failure, you're going to get punished, there's going to be consequences, then they start shrinking. And then you never know what Tom Brady is capable of doing, or you never know what the receiver is capable of catching. So, in order to test your limits and push your limits, you have to create an environment that's safe for them to try new things and explore with what they can do. One example would be, defensively, especially, you know what the other team is trying to do. You're reading, you're anticipating, you're picking up cues. And anytime the team is blind, the ball handler is blind, the decision maker is blind, he can't see you. Is there an opportunity for you to go for a steal? You notice a tendency every time the ball handler goes between his legs right to left, he's going to retreat dribble. Can I pounce on that retreat dribble and try to strip the ball from him? There's areas of the game that I just think offenses are so good, right? 115 offensive rating, 9 times out of 10, they're probably going to get a good shot or score. So with that, how can you be more disruptive without this distorting your entire defense? I always look at OKC. They build that into their program. Cason Wallace, yes, they have good defensive players, but I think they allow certain situations for them to increase their aggressivity. Ball in the paint. We're swarming. Two hands, go for the ball. Closeouts, paint, kick out threes. We're running the guy off. We're not letting him shoot the first catch three. He's got to swing it or drive it. So you empower them to make those decisions in the game. And then if it doesn't work out, you can't lose your mind about it. It's just part of the learning process.
So I was thinking exactly of OKC, and I know you've studied Cason Wallace and some of what some coaches might consider risks, but it's built into the foundation of how they defend that if he can make a read, he's going to go for the steal. And it's really empowering, not just for him, but for the team, I imagine, as well.
The calculator risk is a big part. You don't want just guys playing reckless and gambling and just all over the place. You want there to be a purpose and a reason. And then it's just like your skills of a jump shot. You can start honing those skills and realizing, hey, this is what works, this is what doesn't work. You just want to have as many weapons in your toolbox that you can have to attack the other team and dictate tempo.
I don't want to oversimplify this, coaches, because it's not that easy, but it is easier than you think. And Charles framed it for us, is the three E's that I share all the time. Create the environment, let them explore the environment, and then the explicit instruction as needed. But if you start with the explicit instruction, this is exactly how we're doing it, they won't explore and they won't feel safe and they won't develop conceptual as much. It doesn't mean the absence of teaching or instruction. It just is somewhat what Charles is saying, and what I agree with is don't start with it. So we give them the baseline, the foundation of the defense, and then let them explore it and then see, because individually they're different.
Yep. And then the next stage of that would be the evaluation. Did it work? Didn't it work? Why not?
That is the fourth part of all the three E's, is obviously it still comes back to the feedback, the evaluation, and then what we're going to do with that information from there. And talk to us, because we've gone down this route where, and this is also, I think, a really positive part of modern coaching, is moving away from just one system that everyone plays to changing it for the individual and the law of biological individuality. So talk to us a little bit from your experiences. How can we account for the individual differences within a player? Like, we're seeing it obviously in the playoffs. If you have a Rudy Gobert, you have a Wemby, it's completely different, but it doesn't have to be that extreme to have differences.
This kind of goes back to the whole taking an inventory and an audit of your roster. And then I think also when you're explaining things to your team, whether it's in a film session or on the court, just touching on, hey, this player has a unique skill set. When, let's say, Lu Dort is guarding the ball, we don't have to help as much. He is a primary defender, he's our ace defender, and we can leave him guarding one-on-one. Or, like you just said with Wemby, Wemby's in the game, everybody's going to stay home. Pressure the ball. If they drive it, that's a win for us. So it's all those small nuances of the game that you have to be able to apply. And a lot of people say this, there's only one Wemby. I totally get it. But we all have those certain types of constraints on our team. And basically, how do you leverage all your advantages that you can possibly leverage? And that also means what coverage you're going to use in a game plan. If you have, let's just say, Jaden McDaniels, he's an unbelievable defender. Right. And if he's guarding Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, I don't want him to switch off the ball and guard AJ Mitchell. You want to keep your primary guy on their primary guy. So you build your game plan around, hey, we're switching one through four, except this matchup. When it comes to this, he's staying with Shai. You're going to maintain, get through, whatever it is. We're not switching because that's just going to lead to double teams, rotations, and now we're screwed. And then I think the other thing is if you need to get the players to have high self-awareness and be able to evaluate themselves honestly. It doesn't have to be brutally honest, just honestly. Hey, I struggle with closeouts. I know this. Everybody knows this. I watched the film. I sat down with our coaches, right? But I helped the team in a lot of other ways. I'm always in the right place. I shoot 40% from three, whatever it is. So knowing that, hey, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to try my hardest to get to a shot bubble within 3 feet, make them put it on the deck, and we'll react from there. Now, the other four guys, they have to know my strengths and weaknesses as well, so we can leverage it and not get beat. A lot of times, it goes back to being vulnerable and transparent. And when you're playing basketball, you have to have a healthy ego and believe that you can do a lot of things on the court. I totally agree with that. But you also have to be realistic, knowing what your weaknesses are. And when you can get the whole team to identify those and admit to them and not deny them, you're going to be a better team.
Many things to take away there, but to answer the question again that I asked about the individual differences, one of the main things that you said, which I think is so powerful, is just acknowledging them. And I think a lot of coaches, for whatever reason, don't necessarily acknowledge the individual differences. And again, everything you're trying to do is to try and help the individual player be more effective. It's like, we're not saying this from a point of weakness, we're saying this from, this is your reality, and now let's help you be better individually, so our team's better. And I've used that framing a lot with young players, particularly.
Yeah, and what we also try to do with that is so every lineup we put on the court, I would always try to identify like basically the quarterback of the defense, right? So if it's, say it's Tumani Kamara, right? He's the best defender on the team. during a huddle, I'm going to ask him, what do you see? What do you feel? Should we adjust? Should we not adjust? What's hurting us? What do we need to start taking away? And just get him really engaged in the game because he has a unique skill set, again, of really understanding the defensive side of the ball. And then there's sometimes you ask the entire group, hey guys, what are you feeling? What are you sensing? Is it working? Is it not working? Because so many times coaches get criticized for making adjustments or not making adjustments without really knowing all the information that is being coached or talked about in huddles, where a lot of times, did we do what we said we were going to do correctly with enough effort, with enough technique, with enough communication? It's one of the fine arts of coaching. You don't want to pre-adjust or adjust prematurely, and you also don't want to wait too late. And that's where you need multiple inputs from the guys on the floor.
It also shapes what we've talked about on this podcast since we're talking to coaches, is that the way media portrays adjustments is much different than the reality of the way coaches portray them and players portray them. And that's a really important point that you made, is that like mostly it's like we did it great, they just made a play. Or we can
Right.
do what we're trying to do better in some way. And those are the biggest adjustments. And we'll come back to that maybe a little bit. Hey, coach, I'm excited to let you know that we just released a full 86-minute masterclass on how we developed youth players and teams in simple and easy to apply ways. These are the same methods that I used with local teams here in Los Angeles that have gone from getting beat by 30 to beating teams by 30. At Basketball Immersion, we coach kids for the long term, so they're still engaged, confident, and improving later in their basketball career, not just winning games at 8, 9, and 10. When you join, you get access to a youth coaching masterclass that's transforming programs around the world, plus our full library of incredible ready-to-use resources and courses. This masterclass alone is worth the investment, and your players will thank you. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sales today to get started.
Let's talk about the medal system, because I know we've shaped this a lot for coaches, the bronze, silver, gold medals from an offensive perspective. But talk to me about it from a conceptual defensive perspective.
Yeah, basically, all you do, basketball is such a beautiful game. You're always trying to look at what the offense is trying to do and then how to beat it and vice versa. So a lot of offenses, they create this gold, silver, bronze medal system, right? Gold is a free throw for the many reasons of stopping the clock. You can get subs in, you can set your defense, normalize, take a good player out of the game, normalize your opponent. Silver is usually layups, easy, open, uncontested ones, and the bronze are like threes, basically spot up threes, wide open, off an action where the shooter comes off clean. So defensively, using that same model for defense, what's a gold possession for us? If we prevent them from getting to the free throw line by being clean and disciplined with our techniques, staying down on shot fakes, not reaching or grabbing from behind, just like smart basketball, right? That's a really good possession for us. So we call that a gold possession. And the same thing with the silver possession. If we're preventing layups by walling up, taking charges, blocking shots, maybe fouling a bad free throw shooter, those types of things, we're going to put those in a category of silver. And then if we're limiting the high value threes, like I said, that's a bronze possession. Did we let them shoot it? Was it from their best shooter or just an average or below average shooter? And those bronze isn't bad. Third place, that's a really still a really good medal. So I don't want you to think that's necessarily a negative, but it's just a way to categorize those things. Because I think when players understand the totality of exactly what you're trying to do on offense is probably exactly what you're trying to take away on defense, and everything starts to make more sense.
Yeah, my phrasing for that is basketball is a game of opposites, right? And it just helps a player understand, hey, we're trying to create space on offense and we're trying to take away space on defense. So it's this push-pull, this give and take, so to speak, back and forth. And I love that framing of that, regardless of what you call them, whether you call them bronze, silver, or gold, or you have a number system to it. It's like there should be a counter one on defense that are the similar goals, because it just helps a player understand those things. Talk to me about a check system for possession. You've talked about evaluating possessions and different things like that, but what is a check system for possession spectrum and selection?
Yeah, offensively in Denver, the quality of your possessions basically involve a few different things. Obviously, if you can put pressure on the rim, what process are you using to get advantages? Is it establishing paint touches? How many times can you engage a second defender or just draw help? and then the different modes. For us, we felt in Denver the ball should always touch the paint or touch Nikola's hands, and good things will happen from there. And then I just added basically, how many times can we involve their worst defender on and off the ball? When it comes to the process of how we're getting the paint touches or drawing a second defender, one thing in Detroit, Coach Van Gundy had me do was we called it heart of the defense, which is the dotted area, basically right where the lower defensive box starts. And what was our defensive stop numbers based on if we prevented the ball from touching that area compared to when we allowed it to touch that area? And when it touched that space, 70% of the time, the team scored. And if we prevented it from getting to the heart of the defense, it was down to 40%, which is really good. And then when I started doing it on the offensive side of the ball, what I realized is it's not just about the paint touch. It's really about could you draw a second defender? We had a guard, Ish Smith, who is a dynamic ball handler that could get downhill in an instant. And so many teams were shrinking so heavy back then. If he could just drive the nail and get that second guy to engage, and then everything after that was just advantage-based basketball, dominoes. We were good. That's all we needed was that initial trigger. So if I was a offensive coach, I would definitely chart how many times are we engaging the second defender.
Makes sense. And I do want to stay there for a second, and maybe this goes into offense a little bit, but what does it mean to draw help? How do we define that? I'm asking coaches quite a bit this concept because I think sometimes, especially at the youth level, the framing of drawing two is literally you're getting trapped before you're making a decision versus, say, a high paint decision or a low paint decision, and some of the things that come with that.
The standard for most teams when they're shrinking is they're going to be halfway or midpoint between ball and man. If any time they're ball side of midline or ball side of the midpoint, right, and you've engaged that guy to take one more step towards you, so he becomes a 60-40, then we're probably getting off the ball. You could use the reference as being trapped, like a severe double team. That's a little bit different in my opinion, but a lot of the times the way teams are built to shrink the floor, if you can just get them to take one step in their stunt or their bluff, and then I'm getting off it and we're playing downhill advantage basketball.
Yeah, I'm definitely not encouraging the trap part of it because that gets all youth players in trouble. And like, I've literally gone to the point of exaggerating it to the point of saying, as soon as you see them turn their chest, move it because they've committed somewhat towards you and just getting them to pre-move it because they tend to late move it type of situation. So I love your framing of that of the 60-40.
Yeah, so a great example of this, we had Reggie Bullock in Detroit, and he was an excellent backdoor cutter. And I said, how are you so good at cutting? And what he said is, I know where the defense is supposed to be, and when they're not where they're supposed to be, I take advantage of it. And that was simple as that. So he's up in his gap line. He's not where he's supposed to be, let's say. We're taking advantage of it. And now do you have the tools and skills to do?
A trend on offense is pace over precision. So we know
Correct.
that relentlessly attacking with speed and force and tempo. So how do we counter that?
Yeah, everybody on defense wants to get their defense set and get back to neutral, and that's where the offense starts to re-trigger things. But that's not always going to happen. The good offenses won't let you do that. And because there's so much movement on the floor now, whether it's actions on both sides, whether it's the Clyde and corner cut, wing to corner fill, whatever it is, it's really hard to guard things the same way every time. So being locked in, aware of what they're trying to accomplish is super important. And what we try to do a lot of times is really demand the effort, intensity, and focus over the technique. Technique is great if and when you can apply it, right? Maybe it's a dead ball side out and they're already in their spots. You already know what's coming, right? But most of the time in flow offenses, in transition, they just get to one action to the next. That pace is going to prohibit you from applying your certain techniques. So that's where it goes back to giving them the ideal guidelines. In a perfect scenario, we would want to do this in order to stop that, right? But knowing full well that those conditions are very rare. So it's a lot of conditional statements, and you hope that the players understand that and they don't abuse some of those privileges or rights or freedoms. If you say, we use the word if a lot. And I know that might sound soft or no, you have to demand it. It's not try to, it's do it. But you see the game. Every team is scoring 115, no matter what defense you do. So you better have some workarounds to the quality of offenses that are on the court nowadays.
Give us an example of the if, and I know you gave me one offline, which is if time permits, pre-switch. Maybe start, what's a pre-switch for those that don't know, and then why is an if statement so important here?
For me, it's okay. Did you have the time to recognize and anticipate their intentions, what they were trying to do? And if that's the case, and you do have that time, you can apply different coverages or different schemes. So, like for us, a pre-switch a lot of times is say a team is on a side out of bounds and they're just going to set a 4-for-1 pin down zipper to get the point guard the ball to run a mid pick and roll. Every once in a while, you could have the X4 and X1 pre-switch that. So now X1 is sitting on 4. And as he goes to screen down for 1, he's just switching back to his original matchup. And you can even get aggressive there, situational disruption, and deny him from catching the ball and try to get a 5-second count. So that would be one. And most of it is you want to teach the players the cues of what to look for, right? So if we're flowing down into a 5-out set, everybody should basically be looking at the trail spot, the 5-man, to see what's going to happen. Most offenses revolve around what the 5 does. Does he screen on ball or is he looking off ball? Not a lot of players use deception before they screen. They just get right to what their coach wants them to do. So if I'm off ball and I'm thinking I need to be in a shrink and I realize 5 is not going to an on ball, he's coming towards me. That gives me time to prepare a certain coverage. Hey, I can get into the body. I can top lock. I can send it down. But again, that's the purpose of why they play with pace. They want to prevent you from doing your prescribed coverages.
I think it's important that you're giving coaches an example of what is conceptual. We may prefer pre-switching in this situation, but it's still an if rather than a must. And that's a key part of this. And you referenced another one, so I want you to maybe give us some other examples. But you referenced Ish Smith has the ball. Then our defense is early, to coin a phrase from Dave Smart that I adapted a long time ago, was versus a matchup that can drive us, we're going to be early shrinking the floor. Versus a matchup where we can control it, we're going to be dead, meaning no help, we called it. So those are conceptual things. And again, a lot of those come back to if statements. Can you give us some maybe some other examples so coaches can continue to understand what can be conceptual?
Yeah, another one for us is like in pick and rolls, when you're trying to recover back in front, we always say speed up to square up. And then the whole veer or like peel switching is if I can't get in front by the shell border, I'm leaving that to the next guy, the help guy or the X5, whoever it is, I'm peeling off, I'm getting back into rotation. I call it don't go down the rabbit hole, let the help be ahead of the action, and then you peel off and get out. So that's one of the if scenarios that we use. Another one is a big one I like to use is the whole zone switch concept. So there's so many offenses that will run an action on one side or a first action just to get to a second or third action or third side. And a lot of times you can't guard it the same way, right? If I know it's coming head on, I can guard it the way I want to guard it. But now if they run a 1-4 step up on the right side of the floor and 4 rolls, and X3 is in the left corner, and he's got to tag the roller, but then they quickly throw it back to run a zoom for the 3-man in the left corner. I can never recover. I can't give paint help on a cut, a drive, a roll, whatever it is, and expect to get back to my guy. So that my partner on the perimeter, we're going to zone switch. I'm going to tell him to stay high. He's got whatever comes up the floor. I'm going to stay low. I take the leftover guy, whoever remains at the bottom of the floor. So it's, hey, I can't get there. I'm required to help. I can't be in two places at the same time. We zone switch.
And this leads into a little bit more depth on the contingency plan, the contingency-based decisions, right? The example that came to mind as you're talking about this is obviously X outs. We were okay. We wanted to X out. But at the same time, it's like sometimes you don't X out because sometimes it didn't make sense. But the X out is there to be able to solve a problem. And I am curious, and this may be an aside, but I think a lot of conceptual defense has evolved also because we've got so good at advantage drills on offense. We've given so many advantage situations to the offense in small-sided games throughout the last 10 plus years that all of a sudden now defense is just figuring things out because you can't script a scramble, can you?
No, we talk about that all the time. If you're double teaming the post, again, if the pass goes here, we rotate like this, we rotate like that. Yeah, there are some situations where you can really, hone in, but now teams do different things. Like back in the day, James Harden with Houston, they would run an angle pick and roll and nobody would cut. He wanted everybody spaced in their spots. He would be able to make the blindfold pass and somebody would be where they're supposed to be. And now the Nola Roach Memphis last year, everybody cutting, everybody moving, doing different things on every possession makes it really hard to guard. So you can't always apply one rule to all these different scenarios. That's where the whole read and react based on your instincts come into play. So what we like to say is anytime we've had to give paint help, right? The ball penetrates our shell, cracks the shell, gets into the paint, and they go to kick it out. Basically, everything after that is a scramble. And I know that that term scramble can really freak some people out. But I think what it does for our players is they understand at that moment, we're at a disadvantage. How do we recover? Don't get too caught up in personnel, KYP, who's who goes where. What was my responsibility? The big thing we're relying on at that moment is just sheer effort to put out the next fire. That's all it is. And that helped players just think less at that moment and just do. I think back in the day when we said, hey, if when the ball hits the paint and they throw it to the wing, it's an automatic X. And then was I helping? Was I not helping? Is it an X? Is it not an X? Who calls it? When do they say it? All that kind of stuff. It kind of just removes some of those responsibilities to just act fearless and free. Another phrase we like to use, especially when it comes to some of these situations, is unless communicated otherwise. Okay, so we'll go into a game plan and we'll say, hey, we want to switch 1 through 4 on and off the ball. And then all they're doing is running a pick and roll at 30 feet just to get the bad defender on our primary player, right? So don't give in to the switch. You hear it all the time. Don't give in to the switch as much as possible. Only switch out of necessity, not out of convenience. Or they're running a rip screen to get the four man, Aaron Gordon, posting a small. That wouldn't make sense to switch that because you're just creating a problem. We have our base system, but understanding how they're trying to manipulate this and then mitigating against that. So again, a couple of phrases we like to use a lot. If time permits, you can apply different coverages. And then we want to do this unless communicated otherwise. And we always honor the call on the floor.
I couldn't agree more that we're switching everything except if we don't have to, right? And it's so funny because sometimes in the NBA, when you're watching these games, you're going, why did they switch that? They didn't need to switch that. And just it becomes a habit a little bit and building that conceptual decision. Another phrasing that I love that you shared with me that I want you to talk about is possessions are finite. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it just goes to the what you want to do defensively in the first 18 seconds, let's say, might change in the last 6 seconds. So knowing that, how can you use the clock as your ally to maybe put more pressure on the ball handler? Luka Doncic, at the end of the clock, he's going to shoot a step back. So do you adjust your stance to then force him to drive when the first 18 seconds of the clock, you actually don't want him to drive? Whatever your game plan is. So, knowing that they don't have forever to do whatever they want. And how can you take advantage of that? It could be the last 6 seconds when we're in a butter situation, all threes are runoffs. We're making them put the ball on the floor. It could be, hey, when Ish Smith has the ball and he's isoing, everybody's staying home. We're forcing him to beat us one on one. So, it's like it just goes into the layers of situational and conditional basketball. And again, how can you leverage the fact that they're deep in the clock?
What is the mitigation process of risk reward here?
Yeah, basically, you have to weigh the situation in the game as well. Are you up 20, down 20? Have they scored 3 straight times? Do you need to just disrupt them one time by trapping or blitzing out of a timeout or going to a zone? And a lot of times, you're always going to weigh the cost and benefit of everything. Okay, we haven't worked on our blitz coverage as much as we would like. There's a chance that it could fail or go wrong, but the benefit is the other team's not ready and we force a turnover and get a high value possession going the other way. And then you just have to figure out your risk tolerance with your other coaches and your players. Some players, they don't want to take risks. They want to stick to the script and do what they do and just nail home their defense. And some players, they feel like you're empowering them if you let them take some calculated risks. The whole reward part of it, is this something that only works one time because they weren't ready for it? I talked to a lot of different coaches that do different things, whether it's nexting the pick and rolls or the force everything left. And what I found is a lot of these things are good in low doses, but the offensive players are so talented. Once you give them the same script or diet of coverage over and over again, they're going to manipulate it. They're going to exploit it. And then you're going to be playing from behind. So you got to be more proactive defensively, even at the risk of maybe giving up one or two baskets.
And would you say when people, armchair quarterbacks, are criticizing coaching in the NBA, I would say that's one of the things that is least appreciated, is that notion that it's, yeah, you can have your system, you can have your belief at the high school level and the college level, but to a certain extent, the NBA level, these players figure it out so much faster. And Zach Guthrie, a good friend of both of ours, he framed that for me when we did the CLA clinic, and he just said, listen, some of these advantages or disadvantages that you're creating for an NBA player, that would be done in a minute. And it's like you got to be constantly figuring things out, how to shift it, how to change it, just to try and put a player off balance. So I love that notion of this. And that obviously, no doubt, Charles, that makes it really fun at that level, but also frustrating.
Yeah, a lot of times it's pick your poison. You're under the assumption if you're going to take away something, most likely you have to give something up. And what are you willing to risk? How are you willing to lose is a great question. And then the biggest thing I think from a coaching perspective is remember how much time you've budgeted into doing this select one-time coverage. If you go into a 3-2 zone and only 10% of your practices involve zone work, and you put it in and they score an easy basket on it, you can't lose your mind about it because you know you just didn't have the time to dedicate to practice and you tried it and it didn't work. Curveball, change up, we're moving on. I think sometimes we try to take away everything, which is fine in the mentality of, hey, we don't want to give them anything easy. But again, it's basketball. It's never been 0-0. You have to pick your poison and you just can't, you got to move on to the next play.
Another great frame for phrasing from you is this concept of help is always ahead.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, but it kind of stems from the whole peel switching concept and being able to read, do I need to help? When do I need to help? Is it a big advantage? Is it a small advantage? Is it a spacing advantage? Is it just a talent, athleticism advantage? What is it? And if I need to help or not. There used to be rules like, hey, if they catch it on the lower box, we're double teaming on the pass or we're waiting for a dribble. And then the whole thing became like when the player's in the scoring area. And then you get a guy like Steph Curry, and when he crosses half court, that's his scoring area. So it really changes, it changes everything, right? But we want to pressure the ball as much as possible. We want to blind their vision because most of their decision making comes from what they can see and what they can process. So when you're pressuring guys, there's going to be times you get beat. It's the game, right? And if you cannot recover in a timely manner, let the help stop the ball, and then you go to where your help came from. Just the whole peel switch concept. I think sometimes we get too nervous with trying to stop both the ball and my guy. But when it's a clear blow by, it's obvious. Just sell out to the help. We'll scramble to a three. Save a layup, scramble to a three. We say it all the time. Find the next job, put out the next fire. And again, you have to trust that your team is going to be behind you in those areas and that if you do your job, somebody's going to do their next job to protect you. But again, it's easier, I think, to be more aggressive because when you're more aggressive with your help, it's an easier read for the other guys. When you're indecisive or halfway or unsure or don't think you can make an impact, now the other four guys, they're not sure what you're doing. So how can they be sure? So it's a level of certainty and clarity when you're just more aggressive and the help should always be ahead of the action.
That's great phrasing and a great way to be able to think about things with that. And then we talked about personnel a lot. What's interpersonal relationship, interpersonal relationships, know yourself, know your teammates, know your opponents, know your environment. That still is the foundation of all conceptual defense, isn't it?
It is. It is. And this takes a lot of time and a lot of introspection and self-evaluation and group evaluation and coach player evaluation because you're going to be limited based on what your players know, their instincts, what they're capable of doing. So in order to play conceptual offense, defense, basketball, whatever it is, you have to understand, like, what am I thinking? What am I capable of doing? How do I process information? How do I anticipate the next action? What are my capabilities? What are my strengths, right? So that's one voice or one channel going on in your head, and that's a lot. And then you have to think of the same categories with the other four players on your team, right? So your interpersonal skills and relationships, who's guarding the ball, who needs help, who doesn't need help, what's the time, what's the score, what's the situation, and then who's the opponent. And then basically, so it's yourself, it's your other four teammates, right? And then it's the other five opponents. So as you progress through the season, hopefully you know what you're capable of doing and your teammates, and then you're starting to focus a little bit more on your opponents. And the one thing Nikola used to always talk about was knowing the other nine. What are the other nine people doing on the court? What are my four teammates doing? What are my five opponents doing? And if you can anticipate and read and react what they're doing, you're always going to be ahead of the action and anticipating to make the right play. Now, the process of doing this, how you do this, is very difficult and very time consuming, but it's very impactful, right? So as coaches, really like guides for these players to start to understand themselves, right? You want to ask a lot of questions. The days of just telling them always what to do are far, few and far between. Right now, it's more asking, right? You want to add context to their thoughts, figure out why they think the way they do. What are some thought-provoking questions where they can go back and reconsider their own beliefs? And once they get past some of those layers and they get a full understanding of what you're trying to do, the better your team will be, the more conceptual you'll be able to play. It could be watching individual clips of your players, maybe small groups, maybe of other players, just to foster conversations of, hey, what were you thinking? What were you seeing? What did you notice? What didn't you notice? What other options were available? Why did you choose this decision? I think a lot of times we have to get to the bottom line of how they think. And that way, you can teach them other methods so they can exploit the opponent. That's what it comes down to. You can do some role playing. If you were in this scenario, what would you do? What would Kevin Durant do? What would LeBron James do? Why do you think they did that? So they're learning vicariously through some of their role models. And then what you do in those stages too is you're evaluating the guy. The player has very low self-awareness. So in practice, he might not even be aware of some of the mistakes he's making. And now maybe I teach him a little bit differently than another player, because each player has their own game plan of how you should coach them, how you should build a relationship with them. Chris Oliver can take screaming because his grade school coach screamed at him. It actually motivates him. He loves it. Another guy, if you scream at him, he's going to shrink, but he's going to be unproductive and afraid to make mistakes. And then you get half a player. So there's a lot of different ways to coach a lot of different players.
Just again, incredible insights in terms of coaching process, regardless of whether it's conceptual defense or not. Everything you're sharing applies to coaching basketball and being better at coaching basketball. Absolutely love it. So, as we're starting to wrap up this podcast on conceptual defense, we must get into how would Charles implement this? Because I think that's at the foundation of all of this, right? Is like now coaches are like convinced throughout this podcast. Charles has convinced them that they can make their defense more conceptual. We're not saying change your defense. You can make your existing defense more conceptual. So where does Charles start? What is he doing?
Yeah, oftentimes you're just going to come up with a checklist of the most common actions or concepts you're going to see from the offense or from the other team or for players in general. And then when you do that, you have your list, and then how are you going to apply them to the practice plan? A lot of times we're going to put it into small-sided 3-on-3 or 4-on-4 and 5-on-5, and we could huddle up the offense and tell them, hey, we're only playing out of gets. Be random, be creative, but everything's a get. You can keep it whenever you want to keep it. And we're not telling the defense what the offense is doing. And then there could be bonus incentive points. If you score on a get or a keep, it's plus one or double the value of the points. Just by curating those environments, you're like instilling the basic rules that they're trying to learn. And then another thing we'll do is When it comes to 5-on-5, we could put them into making sure that each player guards each action. So having somebody chart, okay, Chris hasn't guarded a get action yet. So the next huddle we have with the offense, hey, make sure you put Chris in the 3 gets. He's got to guard 3 gets 3 times. Or, hey, we know this other team is going to attack our worst defender every time. So in every pick and roll, if Chris is on you, bring him to the ball screen. Bring him to the ball screen. And then you don't want to script everything where the defense knows what's coming and it becomes like a dress rehearsal and then they're just doing the drill. And then the other thing I think you need to do is you need to broadcast in front of the whole group, the other coaches, maybe other scouts that are there or whoever's watching your practice, that it's going to get chaotic and messy. I like to say it's a beautiful mess because that means they're learning. Like scripting it to the very last pass of the very last second, that's not how the game is. So what's going to happen when the game plays out is they're not going to know what to do because you've never put them in unscripted situations. And then if there's any mistakes that are taking place or misreads, whatever it is, you have to learn how you're going to intervene. Is it one player that made the mistake once? Is it 3 players making the same mistake? Did one player make the same mistake 3 times? What I try to do as much as possible is use, like, I call it sniper coaching, where each assistant coach is assigned one of the players. And if they see a mistake and there's a next dead ball or there's a moment where they can just come in, 1 or 2 teaching points, maybe a suggestion, maybe a question, maybe advice, maybe, hey, look for this, and then get out. Because we don't want to lose the flow and rhythm of the practice. And then if it's something egregious, like a system-wide error where you can tell they have no clue what they're supposed to be doing, that's when you got to stop it, bring them in, huddle them up, really get to the bottom of it. And I don't think players mind being stopped if it's going to lead to some sort of growth and learning, right? If you're going to stop and have a diatribe and talk about 17 reasons why we need to rebound the ball and it becomes like a coaching clinic, I think guys start to tune out and then their bodies start to dry up. And you just sometimes, the cost benefit of stopping it isn't worth, let's keep going. Coach more on the fly, stop when I really need to.
Charles, man, there's so much for coaches to digest, the language, the phrasing, the examples. This is awesome. I don't think there's been anything like this on conceptual defense yet that kind of dives this deep and gives coaches such actionable things. I think the bottom line is what we share a lot and what we talk about a lot is just, is there a better way? Right? It's not about right or wrong. It's just, is there a better way? And that's the foundation of this conceptual approach, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean it. You're always trying to distill it down to the simplest form of basketball where they can execute efficiently. There's a lot of stuff that's nice to know, but what do they really need to know? The essential core things. And then what can they handle? If they can handle trig, teach them trig, move to calculus. If they can't, stay at trig, maximize trig, execute, optimize everything, and go from there. And that's okay. There's a lot of different types of players. You're building relationships with them, knowing what they can handle. Because you want to set the standards for what's acceptable, right? And what it's going to take to win. And if they feel like those things are too far past their capabilities, and now doubt comes into play, they don't believe in themselves, maybe they're turned off by the sport, whatever it is, you want to make sure you're always creating a fun environment where they fall in love with the game, fall in love with competing, fall in love with being a great teammate, and just fall in love with the game in general.
Love it. Incredible advice. I'm so grateful. We finally got you on the podcast to share what I know many of us have learned from you behind the scenes. Just so many amazing things. So thank you for sharing with us and thanks for sharing the game.
Appreciate you, Coach. There's a lot of followers of you. For all every 10 people that actually like and subscribe, there's probably 1,000 more that are just closet listeners and closet disciples of everything you're trying to teach.
I appreciate that and grateful for that.